The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on supergenes. The uncanny resemblance between a harmless snake and a poisonous one, mimicry, has been known about for over a century, and it seems straightforward. Take advantage of another animal's scary plumage or coloration, and you reap the reward of a long life. But this leaves open the big question of mechanism. How exactly can genes be selected to adapt in such a complicated way? So, Dave, what's a good example of this?
Well, so one of the very classic examples, one of the first examples of mimicry that was ever found in nature was found in the late 19th century, and it involved butterflies, harmless butterflies looking like toxic ones to avoid being eaten by birds. One of the interesting things that was found was with a butterfly known as the common Mormon swallowtail. And what was interesting about this species was that it was just the females that mimicked a poisonous butterfly species. And even then, it was just some of the females that did it. And so for 150 years, scientists have really been asking themselves this question of, what's the genetic mechanism for this mimicry?
So about these butterflies, how close are the females that are mimics to the rest of the butterflies?
They actually don't look that similar, especially when it comes to their wings. Most of the butterflies of the species have black wings that just have a faint yellow band on the lower hind wing. But these female mimics that are mimicking a species known as the common rose butterfly, they have white shading on their upper forewings. They have reddish, orange, and white tints on their hind wing. They also have a bit of a tail at the bottom of their wing. And you can see a picture of this on the site, just a comparison of these two species. So they really do look a lot different than their counterparts.
So that's quite a lot of traits to consider here. How did the researchers narrow down what genes to look at?
Well, and they thought there was a lot of genes. You imagine that so many different traits would have a lot of different genes. But when the researchers started probing the genetics of this butterfly, they found that actually it all seems to come down to a single gene, which they call a supergene. And what these genes are basically is they're segments of DNA that sit side by side on a chromosome, and they're inherited as a single unit. And why that's important is because that helps explain one of the other mysteries scientists have wondered about for 150 years is why you only have mimics and non-mimics, and you have nothing in between. So you don't have some female butterflies that maybe have some of the coloration of the mimics and some of the coloration of the non-mimics. You either are a mimic or you're not. And this supergene helps explain how all of these traits that are involved in mimicry are basically inherited as a single unit. You can't really break them up. And because of that, you don't really have these intermediate mimics.
What did they find when they took a close look at the genetics?
When they looked, what they found was indeed they found this supergene. And what was really interesting was they found that this gene was oriented in the opposite direction of most other genes on the chromosome. Why that's interesting is because genes during reproduction could actually swap pieces of themselves with other genes on the chromosome. But that doesn't happen with this gene because of its orientation. And because of that, it explains this all or none effect that you see with a mimicry, either that females get all of these mimicry traits or they get none of them.
So does this explain why only females inherit this gene?
Well, it turns out this mimicry gene is known as the double sex gene. It's also present in other insects. And the reason it's called that is because it helps determine the sex of the embryo. And so researchers think that this particular gene is somehow tied to femaleness, and therefore that's why females, at least of this particular species of butterfly, are the only ones who can be mimics.
We're talking about a specific example in this butterfly. Is this likely behind other types of mimicry?
Well, scientists don't really know how many of these supergenes are out there. But if they're fairly prevalent, they could explain mimicry not just in other butterfly species, but in other insect species as well.
Next up, we have a story on how a low-carb diet may not be the way to go. Two recent reports seem to both make the claim that high carbs may be life-extending when combined with low protein, a pretty controversial claim in the face of the low-carb craze that's been sweeping the nation. What has been the evidence so far, Dave, that low-carb is good for you?
Well, Sarah, low-carb diets, which typically involve a lot of protein, have been shown in the past to improve what are called metabolic profiles, such as lowering blood pressure and glucose levels. And some people have taken away from that, that these types of diets make you live longer and live healthier. But there's also been some conflicting evidence. For example, lots of protein has also been linked to heart disease, which is not going to make you live longer or healthier. It's been a bit confusing out there in terms of what exactly you need to change about your diet to live a healthier lifestyle.
So what do these new studies say? Let's talk about the mouse study first. What did they eat and how did it turn out for them?
Well, you know, one of the really complicated things about these studies, as you can imagine, Sarah, is there's just so many variables in our diet. How do you control for all those variables? And that's where these mice came in. The researchers took more than 850 mice and they put them on 25 different diets. So different mice got different diets. Some of them were very high protein slash low carb. Some were high carb, low protein. And what they found was the mice whose diets included 5 to 15% protein and 40 to 60% carbohydrates lived the longest, up to 150 weeks compared to just 100 weeks for those on very high protein diet, where their diets were as much as 50% protein.
Okay, and so then the second study looked at this question in people using retrospective data. What did they see?
Right, so what this study looked at was more than 6,000 adults who were over 50 years old, and these were sort of surveys where the people self-reported what their diets were. And what the researchers found with this was that those that were under 65 years old who self-reported diets that the researchers classified as high protein were a much higher risk of illness and death than a group who took only 10% or fewer of their calories from protein. The high protein eaters were also more than four times as likely to die from cancer than the low protein eaters.
So these two studies seem to make the claim that you can be skinny and short-lived or overweight and long-lived. Is that what they're saying?
Kind of. I mean, one of the interesting things that they saw with the mice was that mice that ate lots of proteins were actually skinnier than those that ate lower percentage protein diet, which is why I think a lot of people have thought the high protein diet is better for you, because if you're skinnier, the idea is that if you're skinnier, you must be healthier. But that's not what the researchers are seeing. In fact, the people and the mice that tend to be a little bit plumper actually live longer than people that are very thin.
So we're seeing two publications here that say the same thing. But what about all the people in the comments section of this article and on Facebook saying diet advice changes all the time? When are we going to get straight answers about nutrition? What's so hard about studying these things?
Well, you know, again, it gets back to the fact that there's just so many different variables here. I mean, it's not just high protein or high carbs. It's the lifestyles of these people. Otherwise, it's exercise, it's drinking habits. With the mice in the study, all these mice were from a single strain, which means they're all very genetically similar to each other. So that can make a difference in the results the researchers are seeing. This is just, diet is just such an extraordinarily complex thing that it's really hard to get simple answers.
And plus, we're talking about lifespan, which means that you have to kind of count up what happens during your life in order to figure out what has an impact or not.
Exactly. And there are a lot of things that happen in our lives besides what we put in our mouths.
And how does calorie restriction fit into this?
Well, a common theme in a lot of lifespan studies has been that somehow reducing calories increases lifespan. At least this has been seen in some non-human organisms. What these studies suggest is it's possible that calorie restriction may actually be protein restriction. And it's not just necessarily cutting calories that makes us live longer. It's by cutting calories, we're actually cutting protein.
Okay, Dave. So what's the next study on the horizon that's going to clarify everything?
Well, I don't know if we're going to ever clarify everything, or at least not anytime soon. But the scientists who conducted the mouse study are planning a low-protein, high-carb diet that will go head-to-head with a restricted calorie diet to see which one of those makes the mice live the longest. Won't solve the mystery, but may get us a little closer to the answer.
Finally, we have a story on historic bowel movements. You're an archaeologist, and you found a gold mine, a sealed chamber dating back to medieval times, undisturbed for 700 years. Upon close examination, you realize the barrels within hold something more precious than gold, fossilized feces. So, Dave, What can we learn from this petrified poop?
Quite a lot, it turns out, Sarah. When the researchers drilled into this fossilized feces, they took some very high-resolution microscopy images. What they found, in addition to the poop, was these virus-like structures. And it turns out these structures are called bacteriophages. And what they are actually viruses that infect bacteria. Here's why that's important. Our guts are filled with bacteria that may be responsible for some very important things like our weight, our susceptibility to disease, even things like allergies seem to be controlled by our gut bacteria. And scientists now have this snapshot back in time of how these bacteria may have evolved over time.
And so when they looked at the phage, they were able to see something that told us more about the past bacteria that we had?
That's right, because these phages were actually carrying genes for antibiotic resistance. And these phages don't just infect bacteria, they actually help transfer genes from bacteria to bacteria. And why that's cool is because it's thought, and this study sort of supports this idea, that over time, these phages may have actually transported some very important genes into the bacteria in our guts, genes that help these bacteria potentially fight off other bacteria. And what supports this is that the fact that this ancient stool actually had more antibiotic resistance genes than modern stool specimens do. And one thing that suggests is that perhaps the bacteria in our guts needed a lot more of this antibiotic resistance because they use these antibiotics to fight off foreign microbes. And you would imagine a few hundred years ago when conditions were a lot less sanitary than they are now, the bacteria in our gut are fighting off a lot more invaders than they might be fighting off today.
So the phage were also carrying metabolic genes. Why would they be carrying those?
Well, again, it gets back to this idea that these bacteria in our guts play a lot of very important roles. They help us break down food, for example. They temper inflammation. And because of that, they're going to need these genes that help them do that. And these phages may have actually been the vehicle for how they got some of these genes in the first place.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about where Bulgaria's famous flying bears came from. Also a story about what happens when you try to combine a bicycle with a tricycle. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got an analysis of President Obama's newly released science budget and who the winners and the losers are. Also a story about a deadly strain of avian flu that has penetrated a biosecurity lab in Seoul, South Korea. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.